This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for October 18th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back, everyone. Well, you know, Jackie, we've talked a lot about technology on this program. And when you think about technology, the first thing that typically comes to people's mind is, you know, the data science and the AI and all that kind of stuff. But there's a whole other side to technology, especially when it comes to things like emissions, which we know is an imperative to reduce emissions, especially in the oil and gas business. And there are a whole suite of physical technologies or physical ways of reducing emissions. And that is really the exciting subject of our show today. And we are delighted to have another special guest this week, Kevin J. Bush. He is the CEO of a new company here starting out in enhanced oil recovery project. And we're going to understand more about what that is. And Kevin's using CO2 from the new Alberta carbon trunk line. So we're going to find out more about that. So welcome, Kevin.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, and it's great to have you. You know, I love to talk about carbon capture and storage. Yeah. And finally, we have an expert to talk about it. So thanks for coming on the show, Kevin. And for background, the Alberta Trunk Line is a pipeline that has capacity to move about 15 million tons of CO2 per year from an industrial site in Edmonton to central Alberta. To put that in perspective, 15 million tons of CO2, that's the equivalent of about 20% of all Canada's powered greenhouse gas emissions, or 20% of all the emissions that come from our buildings. So all of that could come down the trunk line and be injected into depleted oil reservoirs in central Alberta.
So this is CO2 that is being captured from things like big facilities that are emitting CO2, such as power plants and things like that?
That's correct. Yep. Yeah. In our case, it's
And so it goes industrial. Into the trunk line, and then the CO2 is used in things like the Enhanced Oil Recovery Project. So we're going to talk about the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line. And then we're going to talk about enhanced energy. Kevin, you're going to tell us all about your enhanced oil project. And sort of that's a broader topic we're going to finish off on, which is Canadian leadership in carbon mitigation and removal.
Before we start, give the audience a brief summary of how you came to lead this exciting project here in Alberta.
Sure. Well, in my case, Jackie and Peter, after about 30 years in oil and gas, pursuing private efforts and everything, conventional production, midstream production. We were even in the deep cut NGL business for a while. I'd taken some time away from oil and gas, and I got a call. I got a call from a fellow who I'd known for about 25 years but been disconnected with, and he asked me if I wanted to get involved in something. He said it was something that would involve spending over $1 billion, something that would create thousands of jobs in Alberta and had the potential to create over 1 billion barrels of new oil reserves. And what really got my attention was he said it was something that would have the potential to materially reduce Alberta's carbon footprint. So after a few weeks of thinking about it, I decided I was all in. I saw it as something I could use my 30 years of experience in oil and gas and really apply it with existing technology and new ways to accomplish something that was commercially successful, hopefully. At the same time, it was good for the province, good for Canada, and good for our kids. So as they say, the rest is history. That was 5 years ago this month, and here we are close to startup of the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line.
And when is the project starting up?
Within the end of the year, sometime in the next 6 weeks.
Okay, great. And tell us a bit about the history of Enhance and what it took to get to this stage.
Sure. Enhance was formed in 2007. It was formed to be the only entirely CO2-focused producer in Canada. The founders of the company had experience with CO2 and the vision that CO2 EOR was going to be a sustainable business that would be aligned with where the world was heading with respect to greenhouse gas emissions and environmental sustainability. So our vision is to be a key contributor to the world's need for low-cost, low-carbon energy, and we believe CO2 EOR can be a part of that solution. And what we really liked about the business is it was proven the U.S. has lots of experience with CO2 enhanced oil recovery. They have over 130 floods in operation down there, been going since the 70s. Canada has some experience. Weyburn's the biggest flood in Canada. It's been going for over 20 years. So we have a high confidence in the technology.
So Kevin, like the term flood, you know, I can tell you what that means in my basement, which flooded recently, unfortunately. But in terms of oil reservoirs, a flood is basically injecting CO2 the gas from surface down into the reservoir, flooding it and pushing out the oil. Is that right?
That's correct. And we've done water flooding for years. Typically, you drill a well, you produce it until the pressure starts to drop and you put water in. It's called a water flood. And now we're using CO2. We refer to it as a CO2 flood.
Right. And it's convenient because there's a lot of buzzwords out in the industry with this sort of thing. CCS is one of them, right, Jackie? We hear that term all the time, which is carbon capture and storage. And that is taking the CO2 and injecting it back deep into the ground and is sealed and stored forever. But it can also be used in the sort of the CCU or carbon capture and use, where not only are you burying all that CO2 from industrial emissions, but you're using it to flood or push out the oil. So is your project, would you consider that storage or use, or how does that fit in?
Really, we're both. We're utilization and storage. So utilization is something that can create a commercial value. Utilize it. In our case, we're utilizing for enhanced oil recovery. Other people are working on things to utilize it to put it in cement or make carbon straws or things like that. And then to make it storage, of course, the use of the CO2 has to be permanently removed from the atmosphere. So in our case, we're using geologic storage, and it's a permanent storage. The CO2 that displaces the oil is permanently stored in the ground.
Right. So it's both. You're expecting it to stay there forever. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we believe it's permanent storage. We have a lot of activity going to monitor. Alberta does a good job of regulating, monitoring, and storage and the things we put in the ground. So we certainly believe
it's important to recognize that, I mean, you can't push the CO2 back into the ground, the storage in any locale. The geology subsurface has to be right to be able to take it. And so that's why we have this trunk line. Can you talk a little bit more about this trunk line, where it starts, where it goes, and how it gathers CO2 along the way to get to the reservoirs where you can inject? Because you can't inject everywhere, right?
That's right. So the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line Project is, I mean, we refer to it as an integrated carbon capture, utilization, and storage project. So it involves capture. Capture, in our case, occurs up in the industrial heartland. And we have two sources, one from a fertilizer facility operated by Nutrien, one from a refinery that's just starting up, the Sturgeon Refinery. So those are our two sources. We then need to compress that CO2. We bring it up to line pressure. We put it in a 240-kilometer pipeline, large diameter pipeline, and we run it down through central Alberta, where we believe there's an ample abundance of locations to use it for enhanced oil recovery.
So when you say central Alberta, so the heartland, that's just northeast of Edmonton.
That's correct.
And central Alberta, what, like Red Deer?
Red Deer.
Our first
field we're heading to is at Clive. It's just east of Lacombe, Alberta, about 15 miles.
Mm-hmm. And is that pipeline different than any other pipeline? Like, does it require, because I think CO2 must be corrosive. Would it require more expensive materials than a typical pipeline?
Actually, surprisingly not. CO2 by pipeline, we use carbon steel, just like we use for any oil and gas in Alberta. The key is it has to be dry. So CO2 in water creates acid, as you'd expect, and is very corrosive. So when we transport in the transport system, we make sure it's dry going into the pipeline, just like NGTL system or the TransCanada system today, it has to be dry. They dry the gas.
So just like natural gas.
No free water. Just like CO2, same thing. No free water in the CO2 and bare steel pipe. So no super technology. The difference is it's a little higher pressure. We need to keep the CO2 in a liquid form. So it turns into a liquid at about 1,500 pounds pressure roughly. So instead of running the system at 1,000 pounds, which is kind of where the gas systems might run, we would run our system closer to 2,000 pounds.
So even
more
pressure.
A little heavier wall pipe, but really the technology is no different. It's carbon steel pipe.
So who owns this pipe? Who paid for it?
Yeah, our consortium involves, if you look at the Alberta Carbon Trunkline Project, Enhance is obviously a party. The Northwest Redwater Partnership that runs the refinery is a party to that project. They were part of the initial project that got funding. The other parties would be the provincial government, who's a party, as well as the federal government. And then as part of our financing that we completed just over a year ago, we brought in a company called Wolf Midstream. So Wolf Midstream is a fairly new entrant in Alberta in the midstream space. They're a well-funded entity, and they come in to own and operate the pipeline and compression parts of the project. So there's capture, they own and operate the compression and the transportation, and we own and operate the enhanced oil recovery part of the project.
Do you end up paying like a fee for the CO2 that gets delivered to you, or what's the model?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we as an enhanced oil recovery producer, we're the buyer of the CO2. So we go to the sources, we negotiate a price, if you like, to acquire CO2. We take possession, we take title and risk of the CO2 at the exit of their facility. Then we hand it off to Wolf as a midstreamer, just like you might if you're a natural gas producer and you're signing up with Keyera to process and transport your gas. So they compress it, they transport it, they deliver it back to us at our field. So they're a midstreamer. We pay them a toll on a fee-for-service basis.
Yeah. I think it's important to recognize that in the absence of this pipeline, Nutrien and the refineries would be blowing the CO2 into the atmosphere.
That's right? Correct. Nutrien facility has been there for over 40 years. It's been venting CO2 during its whole lifetime.
And the oil fields would be buying CO2 from some CO2 manufacturer and injecting it. Right. So this is sort of like a win-win situation where...
Yeah, it allows a commercial transaction to connect the source with the use.
Yeah.
And it needs to be done in large scale, which is why the pipeline is designed to handle large volumes of CO2. Over time, we certainly expect it to volumes to increase and economies of scale to improve.
Now, the pipeline itself, as I said at the beginning, can move 15 million tons annually. How much will your first project take of its capacity?
Yeah, we're coming on with just under 5,000 tons a day. So that's about 1.7 million tons a year, somewhere in there. And so difference between that and 15 million there, clearly the facility was built with a lot of excess capacity, which is really the key to the province's participation in the project. So they were interested in participating and helping to fund a large project that potentially grow and increase volumes over time, call it the Highway 2 of Alberta. You know, they build it for future growth, and it's here today, and we certainly expect that we'll see volume growth over time.
So could other producers that have oil fields in that area now tie up to that pipeline and start to do enhanced oil recovery as well?
Yeah, you need a source and you need a sink. So a producer that wants to flood a reservoir would need to contract some CO2 from somewhere and then approach the Wolf as the pipeline owner. Obtain a fee-for-service contract and then get the CO2 delivered anywhere that they wanted to off the system.
And are the oil pools that this is applicable for, is that very specialized or could this be applied CO2 flooding to a big part of central Alberta's oil reservoirs?
Yeah, our reservoir isn't what I call unique, but every reservoir doesn't work for CO2 enhanced oil recovery. You need to have a certain pressure. You need to have a certain depth to make sure you've got containment. We typically look for reservoirs over 1,000 meters deep. So central Alberta is kind of prime spot for that, where the basin starts to get deeper. And then you need the right composition of oil so that it's miscible. And really the key is, does the CO2 mix with the oil? And what I describe is, if you get grease on your hands and you want to wash it off, you don't use water. It doesn't work very well. You need a solvent. So CO2 at the right conditions mixes. It's a solvent with oil. And that's what moves the CO2 from the rock, where it wasn't going to move with water or any other process.
I mean, I think one objection that's glaring here is that, okay, you're using CO2, you're burying it, fine, but then you're liberating more oil to be presumably burned somewhere else. So how does, you know, I think an environmentalist would legitimately ask, how does this make any sense?
Yeah, I've certainly heard that. And I think, you know, when we look at it, we think the general consensus is the world's going to need fossil fuel for a long time. It needs energy-dense portable fuel to power airplanes and buses and trains and trucks. And right now the answer is fossil fuel. So I think it's going to be here for a long time. And so we think what the world needs is low-carbon fossil fuel. And so we don't think this is an incremental barrel we produce. This is meeting the world's demand for a fossil fuel, and we're doing it on a low-carbon, low-cost basis.
I mean, it's true that another way you can think of it is that a barrel would have come out using CO2 for flooding, but it wouldn't have been some CO2 that has been emitted from an industrial factory. So there is actually, you're pulling CO2 out of the system.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's exactly it. There's less CO2 going to the atmosphere. We're not changing world oil demand. We're just replacing maybe one barrel that would have been higher carbon with this low carbon.
That's our view, is we're displacing some other energy. You know, are we displacing oil? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're displacing coal. But really, it's, if you look at the net carbon impact of this barrel, after considering the fact that we're leaving CO2 in the ground, we're very low carbon.
And what fraction is stored permanently and what fraction is used for the flood?
The simple answer is every ton of CO2 that comes off the system stays permanently in the reservoir. And I think what people think about is, well, when you put it in the ground, some might come back through a producing well. And that's true, but we put a recycle system in just like you would with if you're injecting water. And so every time it comes back, we put it back in the ground. So every ton goes in the ground permanently.
Now, I think something really important that maybe a lot of people don't understand, I read this from your website, that you said Your oil produced from enhanced oil recovery can store more CO2 per unit of energy than is emitted during extraction, processing, and combustion. So we've often talked on the podcast about the upstream producers are responsible for about 20% of all the emissions associated with the barrel of oil, and 80% is associated with the combustion. But what I read here is for this molecule of oil that you're going to produce, or this barrel of oil that you're going to produce, there is going to be enough CO2 stored to offset both the upstream and downstream. So this is like renewables in a way, in that it's net zero emissions, both upstream and downstream. Is that right?
We think we can get there. It does depend on the specific situation. So, you know, our mission to be successful commercially is to make the most amount of oil we can out of the least amount of CO2. CO2 is our expensive input. So when we look at a very successful flood, you know, that exists in the world, somewhere around a quarter of a ton of CO2 would be left in the reservoir permanently for every barrel of oil you produce.
You made that metric there.
A quarter of a ton. So, you know, if you look at, if we're as successful as the best floods in the world, we think we're going to reduce the footprint of that barrel by about 60%.
Upstream and downstream
emissions. Upstream and downstream. Now, if you look at, depending on the carbon price of the day and how successful we are with our flood, we could easily be leaving a half a ton in the ground for every barrel. And if we're a half a ton, then we're carbon in the carbon negative territory.
Right.
So it really depends how efficient we can be.
Yeah, if you got paid to for that CO2, you might inject more
It's an economic decision of the day, and depending on the price of carbon at that time, you'll decide to manage your flood to a quarter ton or to a half a ton, and that's where you, somewhere in between there, you flip into carbon negative territory.
This is really exciting that you could have oil that would be almost equivalent to renewables, from the fact that, you know, it's the CO2 you're injecting is offsetting all the emissions associated with that barrel of oil. I have a question. You know, we talked about financing the green economy. Well, why wouldn't this project get green bond financing? Or the Liberals are promising to cut taxes in half for net zero clean energy companies. Why wouldn't this qualify? Some of those incentives actually might incent you to inject more CO2 and actually become net zero.
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting way of thinking about it. And I think that given the magnitude of the issues that we face, both on the supply side of hydrocarbons and the consumption, and the fact that the urgency of reducing carbon, I mean, this is a leading way of providing fossil fuels at significantly reduced emissions, if not zero emissions, on a full cycle basis from well to combustion and turning wheels.
Mm-hmm. And if we're going to be, as the Liberals are talking about, if they're reelected being a net zero country in 2050, this type of oil could actually meet that requirement.
I mean, you're already here. So that, you know, that's interesting. And I think that this is a combination of, you know, foresight to build this pipeline, which, when was the genesis of this pipeline? Like, it was...
The idea evolved in about 2009.
Okay, so it's 10 years old.
In 2010, so
10 years old,
10
the foresight, you know, intersecting with the urgency today, and also how conducive it is to central Alberta oil fields. So you're doing this at Clive through Enhance. Is the word getting out to potential other producers in this region?
I think there's certainly more interest, more attention. And again, you know, the challenge is CO2. You need EOR quality CO2. You need it in a pure enough form. Can't flood a reservoir effectively with 50% CO2 content in your stream. Our spec on the system is 95% CO2. So that's the challenge, is to capture CO2, purify it, get it compressed to enter the system.
Well, we have no shortage of that.
No shortage of CO2. It's just the cost of the capture.
I guess the good thing about being, you know, at the heartland is there are industrial plants there that have more pure streams of CO2 potentially that you could capture and reduce the cost of capture that way.
But as you demonstrate that it works, you go down the learning curve, and potentially if it's really working well and the economics make sense in the 2020s and a increasingly carbon constrained world, you can twin the pipeline, bring more down, and it becomes really a showpiece for the world, because there are, I mean, where else in the world are countries doing this?
The States has been doing it for many, many years, but with naturally occurring CO2, so it's not a greenhouse gas mitigation project. They're starting to bring some anthropogenic or man-made sources online now.
Right, but the actual trunk line from man-made facilities.
Right. This is one of the few that's built.
Is there any other one?
Well, in fact, I don't know about anything like this, but there's only 18 at commercial scale carbon capture storage and use projects in the world. And four of them are in Western Canada, one of them being this project.
And one's in Saskatchewan somewhere.
We have a dam or a power plant in Saskatchewan. We have the Weyburn Enhanced Oil Recovery Project that you talked about, and Quest up in Edmonton, which is an oil sands upgrader. So we are world leaders in this. And I think you're right. Something like this, where there's a carbon trunk line that now it's there and people can leverage this infrastructure. I mean, this comes back to one question, though, that I had is, the government obviously helped pay for this pipeline. Mm-hmm. Could this happen without government support today? And if not, like how far are we from making this work just on the enhanced oil recovery economics on its own?
Yeah, there's still a gap without some support, either from a emissions offset price on carbon, which we have today at $30. It's been kind of moving around a little bit, but I think the latest guess is where we'll end up is about a $30 price. And then in our case, to get into the business and start it, to build a much oversized trunk line, we had government support to justify that investment to be the first movers. But even after that, if there's still a bit of a gap, we think the cost curves are coming down. We've only really built three large-scale capture facilities in Western Canada, and parties that have built them, whether it's Shell or SaskPower, believe the next time around it'll be 20 or 30% lower cost. So we think that gap can continue to close. And then after that, it depends on, you know, what's the incentive, what's the economic incentive to be capturing carbon.
Are you getting $30 a ton credit for capture, taking the CO2?
What we generate as an EOR operator, if we go through the regulated process of getting a monitoring plan in place, we would generate $30 net of the CO2 that it takes to get it into the ground. Of course, if we're using power and things like that, it's a net benefit that they calculate. So we would qualify for an emissions offset. And then if we have emissions penalties, we could apply them to ours. Or if we don't have any and we're not big enough to use what we have, we can market them to other people who do. So speaking of offsets
and things like that, you know, in this world of carbon accounting and ESG, which is a huge topic that we've talked about many times on this podcast. So in the world of carbon accounting, getting back to this question of how green is this process really, are you measuring now accurately along the way how much you're using, how much, basically capturing all the data in great detail such that it can be validated, certified, and so we can show people that, hey, I am taking more carbon out of the atmosphere than I am going to put in by burning this barrel of oil that I produce?
Yeah, believe it or not, there is a very rigorous system in place. It's been actually used in Alberta for a while. This project is renewing the regulations, if you like. We're going through a process, and we track everything from every kilowatt of power we use, every liter of diesel we might use to drive to a well. Everything's calculated. It's truly a full cycle, full analysis of our net sequestration, which is what qualifies for an emissions offset.
And is that published somewhere? Do you report that to the regulator?
It's reported and verified. We have to go to a licensed verifier. It gets reported, it gets verified, it gets approved. We get a serialized credit. It's like there's a system run by CSA that does it. So it's been around, and it's a well thought out system.
So Kevin, I want to just highlight something you said, or get you to clarify. You talked about the fact that for the projects that are built in Western Canada, you think if they were done today, they could be, I think, 20 or 30% lower in their capital cost. What would drive that? Just our knowledge, or are there things about the technology that we're going to do differently that would make it cheaper?
Yeah, I believe it's just efficiency gains, hard-fought, hard-earned efficiency gains. If you think of the oil sands back in the 60s when it was first started, the costs were $50 plus a barrel, and where are we now? And is there any real technology breakthroughs? You probably point to some, but for the most part, it's just cutting corners in every area, getting more efficient in every area. And I compare it to wind power. You know, if you look at years ago, they thought wind power was $140 a kilowatt hour, and now they talk about being under 50. And if you look at how they got there, it's taller windmills and better gearboxes and better siting and just optimizing in every area. And, you know, I'm not aware of any breakthrough technologies that got those costs down. They just got more efficient in every area. And I think that's going to be the key to what we do. It's proven. Chemical solvent extraction is proven to be able to pull CO2 out of mixed streams. And we just have to do more. They're expensive. You do them in large scale, but we just have to do more. We've only done three.
Right. So, and that will be helpful if we do them more, we get better at it, it gets cheaper. You talked about the fact you get an offset. you know, the Liberal government wants the carbon cost to get closer to $50 a ton. So mm-hmm. that kind of thing will be helpful in terms of giving you more revenue associated with the CO2 that you are able to inject. So those things will help close the gap in yep. terms of making this economic. Hmm. And of course, we have the big trunk line, which already is a starting piece of infrastructure that reduces the cost for new entrants until we fill it up.
Right.
Yeah. So let's build this up back to the national level and some national discussions on our third agenda item here, sort of Canadian leadership on carbon capture and storage and use. So there's a recent CBC article by Emily Cheung, which I think was really well done. We'll post that, right?
Yeah, we'll post the article.
Okay. So carbon capture, what you need to know about catching CO2 to fight climate change. Can you just talk about how we can demonstrate to the world or the leadership, and are people internationally coming to take a look at this thing?
Yeah, there's interest. There's certainly interest in how we developed and funded the Alberta Carbon Trunk Line. We've talked to groups from Norway. They're looking at expanding their system. They've had a long-running storage program in the North Sea. Really, if you think about it, Alberta is really well-positioned to be a leader here. They're in a very unique position with, we've got a large single-point emission sources. We're an energy-intensive province. We sit right on top of a basin that can handle hundreds and thousands of years of our emissions. And we have expertise. We're well regulated. We have we have a public that's worked with and lived with oil and gas. They're comfortable with what we do.
Yeah.
Just produce and inject substances. You know,
I want to highlight that point about we have the reservoirs to be able to store this stuff, but we have more than that by virtue of having mapped out our geology over the last 100 years and drilled wells. We know in great detail where we can store this stuff. And that's a real plus that many other jurisdictions don't have.
Mm-hmm. And actually with this enhanced oil recovery, there's also some economic benefit, right? We're going to get a price on carbon for industrial emitters. So there's an economic benefit for storing, but then you get that extra revenue from the oil that comes out. That is a potentially a net zero barrel of oil. And so, you know, we could actually see growing production in the basin, especially into reservoirs like your own that weren't commercially producing oil without this next enhanced oil recovery phase.
That's correct. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, no, we are really in an advantageous situation here. And I actually want to highlight it in a different way, is that there are many places in North America and beyond that have point sources of large emissions, big factories and cement plants and what have you, but they don't necessarily have the geology nearby. They don't have the foresight, even if they did, to build this such a pipeline. But even more importantly, they haven't really mapped it out to know where to put the stuff.
Yeah. The other factor is they don't always have the social acceptance to mm-hmm. do it.
So for your project, I'm sure you had to have town halls and explain things to local residents. What were the concerns that people had about the project?
Well, our pipeline project went through what you need to do in Alberta, which is a real detailed consultation, route selection. We did that and we came up with routes that were acceptable. We went through the whole process without a hearing, without arbitration. So I believe the general feeling was this is the right thing, and it's kind of doing what the world needed. In fact, we even had one landowner who we were talking to about routing a pipeline. We decided not to go onto his land, and he asked us if we'd change it and go back on his land. He wanted to be part of this project. He saw it as something he wanted to be
part of. Wow, somebody who wants a pipeline?
Yeah,
right. It doesn't happen very often.
Better sit out.
I mean, I think there's a huge economic opportunity for Western Canada here too. I was looking at the Shell Sky scenario, which is net zero emissions globally by 2070. Now everyone's saying we need to be there by 2050. But in that case, they said they need 10,000 large facilities to be built in the world in mm-hmm. order to make that aggressive okay. target. So I think there's a ton of opportunity if Canada can become leaders at this, figure out how to do it cheaper, better, safer. There's lots of opportunities for us to grow this business beyond Alberta and into other jurisdictions that are going to need this over time.
Yeah, I mean, there's other point emitters in a radius around Western Canada, potentially extending into the United States. I don't know.
Absolutely. There's no shortage of emissions.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of reservoirs. Yeah. It's the capture and the facilities.
And the understanding of how to do it. And as right. I said, the mapping and knowing where to put it. 10,000, eh? We've got 18. That's a good start.
Yeah, we started at 18. I want to tell you, I went to, in Calgary, many people don't know this, there was a big conference at the end of September, the Society of Petroleum Engineers annual conference. So people from mm-hmm. all over the world came to that conference. And they showed a video at the beginning, which was a bunch of younger people from the engineers talking about how they feel like the industry needs to really reduce its emissions. They want to be part of the solution. And one of the last quotes was, can you imagine a world where we had emissions-free oil and gas? And, you know, hey, maybe we already have it. We have an example here potentially in Alberta to show the world that there is a path forward for oil and gas in a low, no-carbon world.
To net it out, yeah. Fantastic. Well, Kevin J. Bush, thank you very much for being with us. Do you Enhance have a website where people can find more stuff?
We do. We've got a website, enhanceenergy.com, and the ACTL also has a website, ACTL.ca, so they can go to each site and
find out more, the trunk line
website. And I will post both of those links in the show notes. I really recommend you look at both websites. There's some videos and a lot of good information to learn more about the project. So thank you for joining this podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.